supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Jennifer Lynn, in for Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is a combo pack. We'll be listening to two conversations Dan had earlier this year, one with Dr. Tamar Chansky, one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorder, and the other with Scott Browning, noted authority on stepfamily therapy. First, we all have anxious reactions from time to time, but sometimes the grip of anxiety is tight and it gets the best of us. In February, Dan Gottlieb sat down with Dr. Tamar Chansky to explore strategies for weathering, weakening, and understanding anxious thoughts. Chansky is a clinical psychologist and founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety and creator of the educational website worrywisekids.org. Her book, Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want, was published earlier this year.
So, Tamar, when we lived in caves and we heard something that sounded like a mastodon or smelled like it, we had anxiety and we did what we needed to do to protect ourselves, and that's how we survived. But these days, I see people reacting to a C on a report card like it's a mastodon. It's a catastrophe. And I like the way you said in your book, you said, we feel like we're falling on a cliff, off a cliff, when we're really stepping off a curb. So what's happening in our brains?
Right. It's not our fault. We're all experts in having this experience, Dan, and what I was trying to do with the book is help us to be experts in what to do about it. So the way that we're wired is that we are working with what one neuropsychologist called yesterday's parts. So we're wired with survival as the goal, which is very convenient when there were mastodons, or maybe even when you're about to cross the street and a car darts out of nowhere. But it's very inconvenient in most other situations when you're trying to, you know, suggest an idea at a meeting or meet someone on a date. That's when it really gets us in trouble to have all those what-ifs going through our minds.
What's going on? What's creating it? It seems to me that we are getting more and more and more anxious over the years. Somebody asked me earlier today, did we have all this anxiety in the 50s and 60s? And I'm inclined to think not. There was anxiety culturally, but not like today.
Right. And there have been some studies that have shown that as well, that I think it was a study that came out around the year 2000 that showed that typical school children had the same level of anxiety as kids who were in a clinical setting 50 years earlier.
For treatment for anxiety.
Yes, yeah. So we've just kind of, we keep leveling up, in a sense, with what we think of as our baseline level of anxiety.
So you've established already that sometimes anxiety is a good thing, right? It keeps us alert to whether this car is coming. And the image I use is, you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night and realize you haven't paid your health insurance, you know, or you're late for that, then anxiety is a good thing. But what happens in the brain where, you know, I'm because I drive slowly, I'm a subject of road rage often. What's happening in their brains that, because I drive so slow, it feels catastrophic to them?
I think about the amygdala is the part of the brain that mobilizes the whole system to fight or flee. And so my tagline, my favorite tagline, is don't let your amygdala ruin your day.
What mediates the amygdala? What the amygdala says, this is a crisis. Then there's our frontal, prefrontal cortex that says, now, wait a minute. You know, it's a car.
Exactly.
It's going slow. But that's not, that communication's not working so well.
It's a timing issue, really, that what comes first is that fight or flight reaction, because that's just, that's how we're built. That's probably, in a lot of ways, how we're able to be sitting here, Dan, having this conversation today. This is how we've survived this long. But sort of, I think of it as a department store in a sense, that first floor is survival down here, the amygdala, sort of the lower brain. And we have to take the elevator up. Take some time. So it takes some time to get to the top where we can then think and analyze and really look and decide and choose all those higher level skills that have nothing to do with just, you know, fighting for your life.
When I feel great anxiety or someone is having a panic attack, there is no time to think. I just want this shut off. Give me a pill.
Millions and millions of people do have that solution. We all feel that way. That's for sure. But, you know, even with panic, if we relabel what's going on and think to ourselves, this is a panic attack, it's a false alarm, then within a few minutes, we will find that, you know, we're not fueling the fire of that panic. And the body will reset itself back to normal. That, you know, that's also wired in for us, that we can't just keep escalating with anxiety. That wouldn't be a good survival
mechanism.
Couldn't
survive it, yeah. We're talking about anxiety today with Tamar Chansky. Her most recent book is called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. Hey, listen, what's the difference between anxiety and an anxiety disorder?
So anxiety is what any of us have at any given time, any day, when we're worrying about something. And it comes and it goes. It's very much tied to whatever situation is that we're dealing with. But an anxiety disorder is when anxiety takes on a life of its own. So we wake up with it, we go to bed with it. It interferes with us getting our work done or enjoying our lives, and that's when we need to get help.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Matt on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I wanted to call in and talk to you about this because it's something that's greatly impacted my life, and I'm actually someone who's studied in the area as well. And I actually remember the day that I figured out what it was, and it was a class, and it was a class on psychology. And in my medical school, I watched as everyone in the room, as they went over the different anxiety kind of disorders, raised their hand and said, "That's me. That one is me." And I have a problem in that I've gone to the point where I've reached a level that the medication that I can take, it's not something I want to do anymore. And I've gone through cognitive behavioral therapy, and I find when I'm in that situation, I feel like I've kind of been there, done that. And I feel like I've reached a dead end. I don't know where else to go next.
Okay. Hold on. Don't go off the line yet. Dr. Chansky?
So, Matt, my thought would be that I wonder what happened in that therapy if it kind of went far enough. That would be my initial thought. So we know that with panic, it's not enough to know that it's a panic attack, sort of talk yourself down from it, do your breathing. What you really need to do is to take the show on the road and put yourself in the situations where panic is likely to occur to see that you can survive it. And you may need to see that over and over again before you really believe it. So I would wonder if that had been a part of your treatment.
I guess what I have is what I would describe as more generalized anxiety disorder. And even the folks that have dealt with me have said, you pretty much understand that your life's not going to end on this, and I don't really have panic. It's just that I'm constantly anxious.
Let me try something on for size. You there?
Yes.
Okay. It's going to sound radical, and Tamar might disagree with me. But let's assume there's no hope. Let's assume you've gotten all the therapies you can get, you have all the understanding you can, that you don't want these damn drugs to snow you. Let's assume this is the best you can do. I want you to just try that on for size. You know, like the Jack Nicholson movie about OCD, As Good As It Gets. You know, just
so this is where it is. Yeah.
Try it on for size. Live without hope that you can get your hands on this, that you can change your brain. Let's assume that what this is Matt, and you're going to have to craft a life around this, like chronic pain, like arthritis in your mind.
Extremely reasonable suggestion, and I'll do my best. I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah. All right. Take care, Matt.
Thank you.
I was surprised, Tamar, that you liked my idea. I thought you were going to throw something at me.
I did give you the thumbs up, Dan.
You did.
So. Yeah. One of the strategies, actually. I mean, you may be right if you meant that seriously, Dan. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we do when we come to a point of acceptance with a limitation is that we stop paying so much attention to it. And that really frees us up. So that's wonderful. But I also, one strategy that I really enjoy using with myself and with my patients is expanding the horribleness even greater than anxiety has told the story, expanding it so far that it just kind of contracts. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that idea in that light.
That's Dan Gottlieb talking with Dr. Tamar Chansky, clinical psychologist and founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety. She is the author of Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. We'll hear more from Dan's interview with her in just a moment. I'm Jennifer Lynn, and you're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM. Are you frustrated with your son or daughter who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and improve your relationship with your child. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia and surrounding areas by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
The new HBO documentary About Face features supermodels of the past, reflecting on their careers and on aging. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Beverly Johnson, the first African-American woman to be on the cover of Vogue, and Carol Alt, who's been on over 500 covers, and director Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who's photographed everyone from Barbara Bush to porn stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Jennifer Lynn. Earlier this year, show host Dan Gottlieb spoke with clinical psychologist Dr. Tamar Chansky to explore strategies for coping with anxiety. Chansky had just published her new book, Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. She's one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorder. Let's listen to more from their conversation. Dan begins by asking Tamar Chansky about anxiety and uncertainty.
That's what we're all afraid of. That's what we all avoid. And there's a drawing in the book of a door that's partway open. And I think what we need to do is to be willing to look at what we are uncertain about, look at the uncertainty. We're going to have to live with some of it. But oftentimes when we're willing to look, we find that we know more than we think about what's going to happen.
What do you mean?
Well, in session and in my own head, often we start out with, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I have no idea how this is going to turn out. And it just becomes a mantra for us. And we don't look to see, well, maybe we have some idea about some parts of whatever it is that we're struggling with. What the antidote really to worry is our wisdom, Our wisdom comes from our experience, living life. That's what's really happening. That's our story. The worry story is the, you know, the catastrophes that could happen but likely won't. It's kind of a more complex picture than just we have no control.
I want to challenge you on that. And there's a quality of truth here. I'm remembering Erwin Yalom, the wonderful existential psychoanalyst from Berkeley. He's an incredible writer. But we had him on last year, the year before, on his most recent book about death. And it's called Staring at the Sun. So he says, facing your death is like staring at the sun. Mm. You know it, but you can't do it. You can't stare at the sun. One more example. I was driving when my van was almost broken down, and I was scared to death. And I said to the person I was with, who wasn't frightened, she was a young kid, and they don't get scared anyway. And I said to her, sometimes I feel as vulnerable as I am. And if I felt that all the time, I couldn't function. And I think so too with this big unknown, Tamar. The truth of our lives is we really have no idea what's going to happen. Uncertainty, I think, is the reality of our lives. And imagine the freedom we would have if we could tolerate uncertainty. Mm. I don't know if that's like staring at the sun. Mm. I don't know.
Right. I think life is both, really. It's being in that place where we have no control, we don't know anything. That's true. And yet we also have things that we can purposefully do. And we just need sort of those two soundtracks or those two rhythms operating side by side.
Ah, you're talking about faith. Faith that there's something inside, that we have resources inside that can help us navigate tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to say, if people don't like that word, it's not exactly the same as wisdom, but there's something there. It's what you know when you're quiet.
Right.
We know the uncertainty when we're quiet, and we also know other things when we're quiet.
Yeah, I agree. We're talking with Tamar Chansky about anxiety. She's a local psychologist, one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorders. And her book is called Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, Four Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. I am really distressed, Tamar, about how many children suffer so much with stress and performance anxiety. And I wonder what can be done about that.
Yeah, so there are kind of two different parts to that, I think, that on the one hand, we as adults in our children's lives can do our job to be mindful of the kinds of pressures that we're putting on our children, talking about college when they're, you know, when they're in elementary school and all the pressures that they pick up from that. But I think also, Dan, because I work with children and adults, that there's so much that we can do to help kids to very quickly stamp that worry voice as something that they're going to have a different concept of the authority that voice and that information has in their lives.
Hmm. Do children do better than adults in treatment?
Children do faster. They'll come in and they'll say, my brain is telling me this. It's really bothering me. Or my stomach is telling me this. So they've already separated themselves from the worry. So they've done, you know, a couple sessions of work right there. And so we can just forge ahead.
What are your four steps?
So the first one, Dan, is called relabeling. If we can recognize that the what ifs and all the warnings that we're hearing in our minds when we're faced with uncertainty are really the false alarm. They're coming from that busy amygdala that's not realizing that it's not a tiger, it's just, you know, a phone call. If we can relabel it as that, then we can take down the significance and the authority that it has in our minds, and we're able to then move forward and sort of look at what's really happening.
How do you relabel it in the middle of things when you're in the middle of it, or can you?
I think of it as a song, really, and I think of it as name that tune. You know, writing books about anxiety and talking about it all day, I still can have anxiety. No one is immune. But the more that you hear it and realize what it's really about, it's just harder to have that reaction to it, because you know how it's going to end. You know you're going to get it out of your way.
What's the next step?
So the next step after we quiet the noise is to see, was there something that got that noise started in the first place? It's about narrowing down the problem to the real issue at hand. Do we have to worry about everything, or is there just really one thing that we need to take care of?
You're going to have to tell us step 3 and 4 pretty quickly.
Very quickly. So once we have narrowed down the problem, we want to broaden our solutions to, you know, what we could do with it. So we may call optimizing as the third step. We may call on different perspectives from trusted people. You're on my possibility panel, mm-hmm. Dan, as I think I've told you before. But think about people who we trust and admire, and how would they weigh in on our situation? The fourth step is mobilizing. And that's really about breaking down the action that we need to take into the small steps that we won't be afraid to pursue.
Yeah, so get your distance, take a look at it, and then find out the wisdom in the anxiety. You know, the anxiety is informative sometimes. And it can guide our lives. Tamar, thanks so much. By the way, I think your book is terrific, and I think I've said so publicly already. So I highly recommend it. It's Freeing Yourself from Anxiety, 4 Simple Steps to Overcome Worry and Create the Life You Want. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dan.
That's Dan Gottlieb talking with Tamar Chansky, clinical psychologist and founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety. I'm Jennifer Lynn, and you're listening to Voices in the Family on WHYY-FM. In this next segment of the show, we hear from clinician Scott Browning. He, too, had a new book come out this year. Browning has written Stepfamily Therapy, a 10-step clinical approach, with co-author Elise Artelt. He's a professor of psychology at Chestnut Hill College in Philadelphia and noted authority on what helps stepfamilies that are having a hard time coming together. According to Browning, recent research shows that given their unique dynamics, stepfamilies are vulnerable in a way that is distinct from typical so-called first families, often leaving them resistant to traditional family therapy techniques. Dan Gottlieb spoke with him in January.
Stepfamilies are always formed in the wake of either divorce or death. That automatically brings issues to stepfamilies that first families don't face.
Yeah, they are always in a situation where there's someone who is missing. And so at some sense, there's always a loss. There's always some idea that they're either going to try to replicate the first family, or they have a loss that they feel is almost impossible to sort of recapture.
So how do we navigate through those waters? You've got a new marriage. Hopefully it's fresh. It's a fresh start. And yet there's these emotions.
I think what's interesting is that oftentimes these step families start, they've been dating, they get along well, and it feels very natural. I think the dating and remarriage don't really connect well, that it, strangely enough, it's not a great test run. Because when you're dating, you're not really conscious of discipline. You're not really thinking about how much affection there is. And so they are usually very surprised, and that's why we'll often see that step families go through a very tumultuous first couple of years. And so it's really necessary for us to help step families recognize what they're often going to hit. And as your introduction is completely correct, there are those families that do fantastically well, but many of them have much more tumultuous beginnings than they expect.
As, excuse me, as a psychologist, you don't see the ones that do fantastically well. What do we know about them?
What we know about them is that, well, a couple things. One is that we do see them in the sense that being a part of the step family sort of professional community, I've run into many step families that are very, very healthy. But we also know from the research Mavis Hetherington did that after about 9 years taking a large population of undergraduates, she was unable to distinguish what young people were from step families and what young people were from first marriage families. That over time, they really look very similar.
Hmm. What are some common experiences step families have?
Well, one common experience is that they are very surprised by how difficult co-parenting is. That they go into it with the idea that co-parenting will not be difficult, and they're often shocked to find out that co-parenting is really an incredible challenge. They also find that suddenly there are loyalty issues that they really didn't expect, places where the child feels that it's inappropriate to feel good about their step-parent because they don't want to have their biological parent feel as though they've been betrayed.
Well, let's back up and talk about that a minute. Because step-families are formed because adults hopefully fall in love
right.
with one another. But that doesn't mean children fall in love, or is it? It's not even realistic to ask them to love.
I think it's a great point. I think that what we see is that it does occasionally, more than occasionally, happen, but it takes a lot of time, and you're absolutely right. The people who are in love are the couple, and so they often feel as though their love will triumph against all odds, and that love is something, as a therapist, we are often very fortunate to have. It gives us some stability when working with these families, and it gives them an effort and an interest in trying to keep going. But unfortunately, second marriages do divorce slightly higher than first marriages. And so what they find is that the divorce occurs quite quickly, usually within about 3 years, because it really takes about 5 years to develop a step family. 4 to 5 years is really the time necessary. And most people would have pegged it to be a year. They don't expect that they're going to be in sort of readjusting and readjusting. And clearly, the co-parenting issues are so much more challenging than they expect that suddenly these couples that are greatly in love, and as you're saying, the children don't necessarily feel love for the step-parent. In fact, the child may dislike the step-parent may dislike the child. What we have found that is most advantageous is if it's mutual relationships. In other words, if the child's willing to say, oh, that step-parent's okay, and the step-parent's willing to say, that child is fine. You know, I know, of course, it's a good kid. And that neither of them are looking for love, that's tolerable often.
You're addressing over and over just now expectations.
Yes.
And our expectations of our new spouses as co-parent, our expectations of kids, and vice versa. So what are reasonable expectations?
Reasonable expectations is that the step-parent comes in and really should be a monitor, should be someone that is very involved as a supportive other member in a relationship, understands the children, gets to know the kids, has concern, but doesn't walk in as the primary disciplinarian. So it is best to think that you're going to have someone there who can be a support rather than suddenly take over and become the boss. That one just blows up.
Yeah, inevitably. When I took a course years ago on step families, and the person who ran the course said that a step parent is better off if they kind of take the position of uncle or aunt.
I think it's a good analogy. I think it's a good analogy to try to find. I think it's hard for people to figure that role out. But someone who is, in fact, legitimately concerned about the child, really can stand right by their spouse, and when discipline is offered, they could be arm in arm, they can really be a unit, but they can't be the one that's directing all the action. Of course, if the other parent isn't home and something happens, like a good aunt or uncle, someone would say something. They would certainly not let the house burn down. But shy of that, you really have to be careful about trying to take over. It's a very difficult situation.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Scott Browning about stepfamilies. Scott, I want to back you up a little bit to the dating phase.
Mm-hmm.
At what point should the children meet the person you're dating?
Well, Dan, I think that's a great question. I mean, first of all, we know from the literature that to marry within 1 year of divorcing, it increases the likelihood of divorce tremendously. Secondly, you really shouldn't introduce more than two potential sort of future spouses to these kids. That I think kids will tolerate bonding with one boyfriend or girlfriend and then maybe still adjust to the second. But in my experience, they won't bond with the third. So you really, I don't mean they might know that you're dating someone, but in terms of really bringing them in, having them go to movies with you, having them come to dinner, start to become sort of connected with your family, children really won't be able to keep on making that bond. And so you have to be pretty sure that you're talking about someone who you really want to be with. And so I think it's fine for your kids to know you're dating, but I would be very reluctant to introduce them until you're quite certain that this is a person you want to stay with for a long time.
And is there a way you recommend of introducing them?
I think that once you really are sure this is the person you wish to have, because I think what happens, unfortunately, is a lot of people use that as the test. The woman, for example, might say, let's see if this guy gets along well with my kids. So she starts bringing him in as if that's the big test. Is he going to get along with these kids? And it's the wrong direction. It's really about her making sure that she's in love with this person, that this person's in love with her. And certainly it's helpful to see how he interacts with the kids. But most people can interact with kids pretty well over a couple dinners and look great. You know, it's really the rare person that is going to look that awkward or that sort of incapable of showing some affection to kids. So most people can be very comfortable for their first few times. And it's not really a great indicator. I think a better indicator is, do you really feel that this person is someone that you are stable with? Can you go through pre-remarital counseling and start to challenge each other? You brought up a very good point about expectations. There's so many false expectations out here. There, people really believe that the stepmother should be able to step in and become mom. You know, even though they don't expect her to take the term, and everyone knows now that no one can be a replacement mom per se, but they don't talk in detail about what is your role going to actually be? What does it really mean to be stepdad or stepmom? And those conversations have to happen.
Beforehand.
I think beforehand, and the research shows that pre-remarital counseling does help, just like remarital counseling or the program, such as PrEP or some of the pre-remarriage or pre-marriage educational workshops, they do work.
So I've got a friend of mine who's been dating a woman for a year or so, maybe more. They're quite fond of each other. They might want to, you know, form a step family, but he's worried about his daughters. He's got two early adolescent daughters, you know, right at or before puberty. He's worried about those relationships. He's been a kind of a single parent. He's very protective of them. Should he be worried?
Is the mother still in the picture at all?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be a little worried. You know, that's you're talking about one of the hot spot ages. Adolescent girls or pre-adolescent girls with stepmothers, there can be a lot of friction there. The literature shows that that population tends to be the most stressful.
That's stressful in any family.
Right. Then you just sort of add to it because stepmothers, it's a very hard role for stepmoms. Men can come in and be instrumental, can throw the ball around, can, you know, bring monies into the family. And they're generally perceived as being sort of okay. But women, we have a very hard time figuring out exactly how to sort of categorize women if they're not maternal. And so, you know, stepmothers have this funny bind in that at one level, they're, you know, saying, I don't want to be your mom. The kids are saying, we don't want a mom. but we don't really know how to judge her if she's someone who's not very motherly. And so it's often a really difficult situation. Going to your friend's case, you know, I'd say that it would be helpful if his former wife was willing to sort of not be angry about the idea that he's dating, because that pressure can be intense. If she really makes it clear to her daughters that I don't want you to be connected to this woman, that can make it a lot harder.
That's Dan Gottlieb talking to clinician Scott Browning, co-author of Stepfamily Therapy, a 10-step clinical approach. We'll listen to more of their conversation after this break. I'm Jennifer Lynn. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Gymnast Dominique Mucianu was the youngest member of the U.S. 1996 Olympic women's dream team, but that path to glory was often filled with physical and emotional pain, and that's a story she's been waiting to tell.
The time has come where I felt my story was necessary to share, and it took me 7 years to get it all out.
Gymnastic legend Dominique Mucianu on her new book, Off Balance. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back. This is Voices in the Family on WHYY. I'm Jennifer Lynn. We're listening to an interview show host Dan Gottlieb did with noted authority on stepfamily therapy, psychologist Scott Browning. They talked earlier this year. Browning co-wrote Stepfamily Therapy, a 10-step clinical approach with marriage and family therapist Elise Artelt. Browning says the book is an outgrowth of many years of teaching and conducting therapy with stepfamilies.
Tell us, Scott, how therapy helps.
I think therapy helps because, in part, it does let people understand what they're going through is normal. It also helps because you explain to families that this is a series of subsystems, that they really are separate groups, and that we can help each of the separate groups sort of become more stable. And there's no reason that some of the traditions and some of the sort of habits of each of the families can't be continued into this new family. But stepfamily therapy also helps people realize that they have to be aware of the fact that children are a certain developmental level. And if they're adolescents, they're thinking about moving away from the parents a little bit. And oftentimes, if someone remarries and these kids are adolescents, because they want to convince themselves that this remarriage is stable and good, they'll try to bring everyone together and have family meals all the time and go out all the time, and it's too much. These kids are in a developmental stage that's trying to push away from it. Stepfamily therapy is also important because it really addresses helping people understand the perspective of the other. And so often in stepfamilies, it's really hard to know exactly why your spouse is feeling the way they're feeling unless you're really willing to hear their perspective. And so often we're more interested in trying to convert someone than to really hear them. And family therapy works for that, as well as helping to correct mistaken beliefs.
Let's go, Webb, to the lines. We've got Angel on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I have two quick comments. I was married twice, actually. Unfortunately, I'm divorced both times. But the first time, I had a great time as a stepmom, and the boy was 10, and he was very accepting of me, and it was wonderful. Unfortunately, that marriage ended. I decided to try marriage again and inherited 3 stepchildren, 17, 14, and 10, and that one was very, very difficult because the 2 younger ones did not accept me or the fact that now there were rules in the house where before there weren't because their father didn't have any when I really met him. And so it was a very tough go. I don't know if family therapy would have helped us or not, actually.
Scott?
All I can say is that it's a chance that it would have. That probably what we would have done is I would have probably met with you and your husband, made it very clear for you to have a chance to have a forum to really tell him how difficult it is to have this situation with the discipline in the home, hopefully get him to the point where he could really understand the role he was playing in that and begin to try to address it. And then maybe have him, he may have had feelings of abandoning his own kids, or who knows what issues may have been going on there. So possibly having him have work with his own children that would stabilize that feeling, but really support you. I think that it would have been the role of stepfamily therapy to have really worked with you and have your husband understand how difficult it is to be a stepmother. I think that that by itself often carries a lot of weight, but certainly who knows what would have worked. And there are stepfamilies that are just too difficult.
Well, and how difficult it also is or was for Angel's second husband, too, about, you know, his loyalty to his kids and bringing her values in that conflict with his. And that's what I would hope would happen in therapy. You talked about vulnerability
right.
in your book. And if people could kind of be safe enough to talk about their vulnerability, that changes everything.
It often can. So I really disagree that it wouldn't have worked. But then again, no one can guarantee it. But I think that everyone has a position. And stepfamily therapy, by making it subsystem, it's making it safer. You're literally saying, we're not going to have conversations that you don't want your child to hear in front of them, because it literally puts the parent in the middle.
So let me put you on a tough spot here. So if I'm in a stepfamily and we're having difficulties, should I go to a regular family therapist? Or
I would say that you have every right to interview a regular family therapist and say, have you gotten training in stepfamilies? I think that so often family therapists think, because I know systems theory, because I know family therapy, I can do this work. And what we have found is that when research was done investigating people who've gone to family therapy as stepfamilies, the thing they reported the most often as being disappointing was that family therapists assumed that they knew stepfamilies and that that model would work for the stepfamilies, and they often it doesn't.
You talked about subsystems in families, and you know, that sounds dangerously close to psycho talk, psycho babble.
All it's saying is that rather than seeing everybody together, you really are starting by seeing smaller groups. You're seeing the couple alone. You're seeing the biological parent and the and his or her children alone. But you're doing this always with the idea that information can be shared. You make it immediately apparent to them that you're not going to be holding the confidence, that you need to be, the therapist needs to be aware of places where there's been misinformation and where there might have been mistakes made that you can try to help correct. The idea being to literally strengthen each small group, make sure the couple is completely stable, make sure that the parent and his or her own child are stable. Start to move towards helping the parent maybe work with the divorced parent if they have a lot of trouble going on. That you really look at it as a model whereby you're trying to strengthen small groups so that eventually the whole subsystem, the whole super system, which would be the stepfamily itself, is completely able to function. They can tolerate the pushes and pulls of stepfamily living.
Hmm. We're talking with Scott Browning about stepfamilies. He has written Stepfamily Therapy, and he's a professor of psychology at Chestnut Hill College. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Pam on the line. Hi, Pam.
Hello, Dan.
Hi.
Thank you. The best advice I had ever gotten for being a stepmom was house rules, to develop house rules. And it was difficult, but my husband and I sat down and said, all right, we want to make rules that no matter who is here, applies, whether it's my stepson or whether it's niece, nephew, whoever comes in the house, this is what is expected of them. And it was the best thing that ever happened for us. We're 33 years going strong, and I have a wonderful relationship with my stepson, and I think he grew up quite fine. It took the pressure off of me being the bad mom or the bad person.
That's a great idea. Could you give us some example of house rules?
Well, when anybody comes in this house, A, there's no cursing. There's B, there's no throwing balls. No, you know, you take your shoes off. You wash your hands. You put the dishes away. This is what's expected of you. You don't leave your clothes on the floor. You don't play in the house with toys and balls or things that could break something. You know, just common sense
yeah.
kind of things that you would expect from anyone.
Well, obviously that worked. 32 years. It's I think you have your own area of expertise here when it comes to step families. So thanks so much for your call, and enjoy. So let's go to the expert.
Pam's right. In other words, doing house rules is absolutely the way to go, because you have to have a sense that neither person is taking over all of the discipline. Now, I know this may sound contradictory, because we talked about the idea that the biological parent should be the primary disciplinarian for the first couple of years. But that doesn't mean there aren't house rules. In other words, it might mean that even in the situation that Pam described, the husband and wife just agree on the fact that there will be house rules. It might be that maybe in the beginning, Pam implemented more of those rules than her husband did with her own kids, and vice versa, her husband, if he had kids in that step family. But the idea of house rules absolutely takes away the idea that there is sort of one person who is unreasonable and one person is too lax.
You've written about normalizing step families.
And that was really an area that I think that step families taught us a lot about. There's a couple things here. First of all, in the old days, it really wasn't clear that step families were unique from first marriage families, and that had to be determined with a lot of research. You know, Hetherington Bray and a number of the Coleman and Ganong, along with the famous sort of pioneer researchers, had to initially establish they're different. And yes, they are. These families are different. But then you started to have a lot of step family groups that were forming. And they started mentioning the fact that they'd been to therapists, and therapists didn't quite understand how unique their needs were. And so it's become very clear now, with a great deal of literature out there, that there are uniquenesses, and you have to normalize these differences. In other words, step families have to really understand that a lot of what they're going through, the stresses, the strains, the developmental stages that they're going through, they are normal for them. And so even though you may marry this man or you marry this woman and suddenly feel as though they're much more of a tyrant than you expected when you were dating them, when you start talking to other step families, you find that many of them admit, I felt the same way about my parent, my partner. They seemed to be stricter than I thought they were when we first got together. And there can be various reasons for this happening. But I think it's incredibly important for step families to realize that there is a literature out there, and it can be very accessible. It's on the web as well, that helps them understand their situation is, in fact, typical.
Where can they find it?
The National Step Family Resource Center, NSRC, out of Auburn University, is a particularly good website that's run strictly by people who, this is not a for-profit, it's strictly done by people who are in the field and passionate about helping step families.
Great resource. We're talking with Professor Scott Browning about step families. He's co-authored Step Family Therapy, a 10-step clinical approach. His co-author is Elise Artelt. Scott's a professor of psychology at Chestnut Hill College. Scott, you alluded before our break to stages step families go through. What are they? Are they predictable?
Yeah. Yes. Patricia Papernow in 1993 wrote a wonderful book called Becoming a Step Family, where she really does lay out a series of stages, starting with sort of the fantasy level and moving into immersion, eventually sort of going from there to moving towards sort of a mutuality and then resolution. But it's a very interesting model of how step families may get caught in one stage. They may do well with a couple stages, and then there's one area where they simply don't negotiate it well. And so anyone interested in that area, Papernow's book is excellent.
How does a step family know when they need therapy?
I think that, like any family, when a step family realizes that the level of stress in the family has gotten to the point that the home is unpleasant, when the couple realizes they can't really talk without going into an argument, and they start to distance each other, distance from each other, and the children are sort of distancing from their own parents or from the step parent, those are all good reasons, and that therapy really can be helpful.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Gunther on the line. Gunther, hi, you're on Voices.
Okay, I wanted to say I went through a step-parenting relationship from beginning to end. I got into a relationship with my wife when she had a young child, and I'd have to say the first thing that was important is that I went into it with an open heart. I think that was so important that she, and her son were part of the same package. And that, you know, you had to make that commitment. So I took that on. The second part of it was that I was the disciplinarian in the relationship. His father was around and quite a bit. And so we had to work out quite a few value differences and things of that sort. And the way we handled it, or the way I handled it, was that I said, when you're with me, we do it my way. And when you're with your father, you do it his way. And it wasn't complicated. It was like having two fathers instead of having a replacement father. That was a really helpful way of working with it.
How old was he, is he?
When I met him, he was 3 or 4, and I took him all the way through into adulthood.
Hmm. That's interesting, Scott, because, you know, a three-year-old almost doesn't know any different. That becomes their lives, having two.
Exactly. Days. I mean, Gunther brings up a very interesting point, is that it really is different when you're really with a child who's quite young. Because a child who's quite young can make that adaptation very easily. They really can say there's dad's home, and then there's being with mom and Gunther, and that adjustment is not a difficult one for many young people. And so Gunther's description, I think, is absolutely very accurate, that what you'll often see is that the child, you know, Gunther said the right thing when he said he knew he was coming into a family with his wife and a son, and that he embraced both of them. And that is so critical. You're not just marrying a woman. In this case, you're marrying a woman who has a child, and that's important. And that this child learned to see Gunther as an incredibly important parental figure who was different from his dad, but also very important in his own way. And therefore, by the time he reached adolescence, when it would normally be more difficult, Gunther already had a very established relationship.
Yeah, Gunther, thanks for your call. Scott, we're out of time. I'm so grateful that you came out. This is such an important topic.
Thank you, Dan.
So
I really appreciate it.
That was Dan Gottlieb speaking with psychologist Scott Browning. He's written Step Family Therapy, a 10-step clinical approach, co-authored with Elise Artelt. The book was released earlier this year. That's all for today's show. You can reach the Voices in the Family production team at voices@whyy.org. Download our shows at whyy.org/voices and on iTunes. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Emily Hawes is our volunteer. Jerome Gallman is our summer intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. I'm Jennifer Lynn. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
You're